Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
What's up, guys? I am so excited to bring you the man that taught us how to not only sleep smarter, but also eat smarter. Sean Stevenson is the health expert, creator, and host behind the Model Health Show. Today, we're talking about the positive and negative effects of inflammation, how our thoughts influence how food affects our body and metabolism, and we also talk about drug companies and why you should take the time to research to really know what prescription drugs you may be putting into your body. I'm confident you guys will find at least one action item to take from this episode to improve your health and optimize your life the way that you want it. And if you do, please leave a review on our podcast. That's the best way to support us so we can get the show out there to more people around the globe. I'm Tom Bilyeu, and welcome to Impact Theory. Sean Stevenson, welcome back to the show. I am very excited to talk to you, and at the end, I want everybody to stay tuned because I'm going to give you the best Sean Stevenson quote, which sums up one of the most important principles you will ever encounter in your life. But first, I want to ask you, for people that struggle with weight loss and or chronic inflammation, what is something that they can add to their diet that would help, or is this simply a game of stripping away?
Oh, it's such a great question. You know, even if we look at something like obesity, it's always important to look at what is the underlying foundation of this outward appearance or this outward manifestation of a thing, right? And so this term inflammation has been gaining traction. It's been around for a long time. And, you know, the Latin and Greek roots, it's essentially to set ablaze, right? Mm-hmm. To set something on fire. And inflammation can get drugged through the mud as this bad thing, and we want to stop all inflammation. But inflammation is critical for all functions of life. Without inflammation, we wouldn't heal from an infection. We wouldn't heal from wounds. We wouldn't heal from a workout, right? It's a critical part of our lives and of our livelihood. However, when we dip into this place of chronic inflammation, right? Acute inflammation is one thing, but it's kind of like a low-grade fever. Mm. And one of the things that we know today is that when our fat cells are overly full, they start to send out sort of this false distress signal, pulling in immune factors as if you're infected. And so researchers at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine found out how this is connected. And essentially one of the biggest issues with inflammation is hypothalamic inflammation in the brain. Okay, so we've got inflammation in the body from the fat cell's distress signal. And they found that this inflammation in the brain was creating more body fat and creating higher levels of metabolic dysfunction. And that metabolic dysfunction and higher levels of body fat was creating more inflammation in the brain. So what do we do to help to bring a resolution here? Because what happens is a vicious circle, obviously. If neuroinflammation is creating more body fat and body fat is creating more neuroinflammation, we're getting trapped in this vicious circle. Yeah. And most people are stuck in that. And their favorite Instagram, you know, account or even their physician isn't telling them we need to address this inflammation specifically in your brain to help to heal your body. So researchers at Auburn University found that there's this particular food, and I don't have a dog in the fight. I didn't care this much about the food.
Not like you're backed by.
Yeah, and you know, I was just blown away that this actually had this action in the body. And what they found was that oleocanthal-rich extra virgin olive oil is able to help to reduce neuroinflammation, specifically helping to heal the blood-brain barrier, which has a tendency to get broken down by our abnormal diet, allowing more of these kind of toxicants into the brain and creating more inflammation.
Do they know the method of action?
No, we know so little still. You know, we know a ton in nutrition right now, but we probably know maybe 1% of all that there is to know right now.
Yep.
It's still so much more for us to discover. And so when folks are reaching out to learn from folks, you got to keep in mind that even your favorite expert knows so little. And we can tend to put all of our eggs in one basket, in a sense, with a certain diet framework, a belief about diet. We might find out later on that olive oil has some opposite effect, but this is what we know right now. And I always like to point people to leaning into tradition. Humans have been utilizing olive oil for thousands upon thousands of years. And it's very simply made, because there's also this movement today, which I'm grateful for, towards addressing our consumption of ultra processed foods. Right now, the average American's diet is 60% ultra processed foods right now.
Whoa.
All right.
I'm not surprised at all, but still hearing you say that is startling.
It's crazy. It's crazy. But we have to be clear.
I grew up on ultra processed.
I know you
food.
Did. Me too.
Brother,
you know?
Ultra processed. So I look at my family, morbidly obese, have been my entire life, but many of them have like managed to get into their 70s. Mm-hmm. And I, at the risk of completely derailing where we were headed, I don't think people of our generation are going to be able to look the same as they looked and live as long as they lived, because my mom didn't get into ultra processed food, let's say, until she was in her 20s. Whereas kids now in the womb, brother, they're into yes. ultra processed food. And I think that 20-30 year span is going to be devastating to people yeah. of our generation. Like, even I am yeah. so freaked out yeah. by the fact that I know my mom was eating terribly when she was pregnant with me. She smoked also while she was yeah. pregnant. That did not help. Yeah. And then my whole life, like, I used to eat fried turkey nuggets and French fries, deep fried turkey nuggets and French fries, almost every night. Dang. You can't do that.
Listen, this is getting into the fields of nutrigenomics and nutrigenetics. We have entire fields of science looking at how each and every bite of food that we eat impacts our genetic expression, and also how our unique genetic makeup leans towards certain nutrients, certain foods that work better for us versus somebody else, right? Now, you're speaking to this really important thing, which is, what if we're doing this earlier? Because there's so much of the body being made, foundational things like your brain being made out of these compounds,
yep.
right? And so, but also mentioning, you know, your family is very similar to mine, very similar. This also speaks to something that we look over, which is the resilience of the human body,
it's
right? You
just
amazing. Said it. We can be in this state where we're probably experiencing four different chronic diseases and carrying an insane amount of excess body fat as well, and still be able to keep trucking along. And the body is always trying to sort things out and to fix things. If you think about something like type 2 diabetes, which here in the United States, somewhere in the ballpark of about 130 million Americans have type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes right now, all right, huge portion of our population. Now, if you look at this condition, so we've got dysfunction happening with our blood sugar, essentially. We've got these beta cells in our pancreas that are making insulin, right? And insulin's getting made and released in response to glucose entering our bloodstream from the food that we're eating primarily. Today, we have the ability to shuttle insane amounts of food into our bloodstream at one time that we never evolved with. And so insulin's gonna be hyperactive. And at some point, it's kind of like a spam, an email scenario happening where you keep getting this insulin message over and over and over again until the inbox, the cell is just like, I'm going to block you. I'm not going to whitelist this message. And it's going to downregulate its interaction with insulin, right? So now we've got all of this glucose running wild in the bloodstream, which it's not exactly like this, but a good analogy is kind of like little shards of glass, right? Can just tear stuff up. This is why we tend to have, you know, When we're in this state of insulin resistance and diabetes, capillary issues, losing vision, losing limbs and things that are further away from the core, right? So where things are starting to get a little bit more constricted, start to get torn up. All right, so with that said, even though we're in this state, the body is making an adaptation to that abnormal glucose to keep you alive, all right? What insulin resistance and diabetes is, it is the body adapting to less than ideal conditions or circumstances
very
to keep
kind
this
way
person alive when exposed to all of this blood sugar that could kill you. Mm. All right. So there's this intelligence and grace that the body has to keep operating and trucking us along, because what people tend to do on the surface is like, well, you know, we're still living longer. No. Right now, this generation is the first generation, and anybody can look this up, that's not going to outlive our predecessors.
Yeah.
That process is reversed, but also with our innovation, you would think our lifespan would continue regardless. We're not living longer, we're dying longer. We're just extending the suffering. With this ultra-processed food awareness, which I'm grateful for, we can get into a little bit of teetering back and forth, because something like olive oil is a processed food.
How much can I heat it, though?
I'll answer that in 1 second. With olive oil, right, we've got a very simple processing. We take olives, we crush the olives with low temperature, right? That's how it's traditionally done. That is processing, but it's minor processing.
Very
versus
simple.
You taking a couple of ears of corn and turning it into Lucky Charms,
right?
Like, there's no connection whatsoever to this thing, and it's so riddled with artificial colors and flavors and the like. How high can you heat olive oil to answer that question? Fantastic question. Traditionally, we're not really cooking with it as much, by the way. Salad dressings, putting it on bread, right? These are some of the ways that would be used traditionally. If we are cooking with it, we've got to be mindful. The reason it's in dark glass is that it's heat and light sensitive, all right? It doesn't change just because you pour it into a pan. So just keep that in mind. The common moniker
What's
is...
What's happening to it when it's getting heated up, though? Is it turning
oxidation.
Rancid? Okay.
Oh, and also, yeah, it can become rancid as well by not being packaged correctly. But olive oil is kind of, you know, if you think about wines, it could stay, like, there was some research that came out not too long ago that they were finding old bottles of olive oil, like, you know, 100 years old or whatever, and cracking into it. And
it was fine?
I wouldn't say it was fine personally, you know, but it was edible and they didn't die.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Okay, so I've heard a lot about olive oil, the benefits, all of that. I'm excited that you can actually layer that on and still get some added benefit, the epithelial lining in the blood-brain barrier, which a lot of people may not even realize. So they know they have one in their gut. I have only heard people talking about the blood-brain barrier as a similar epithelial lining recently. So I imagine a lot of people are unaware of that. If you're getting the breakdown in the gut, you're almost certainly getting the breakdown in the brain. So being able to add something like olive oil and get the effects is tremendous. But I eat a lot of olive oil. But I worry, I always heat it up, always. And I've never been able to get a great answer. I'm assuming it's because there's not a ton of research that says, okay, you can heat it to this point, but not above. But like, for instance, I don't use butter in my pan or anything like that. I eat eggs most days, but I'll put olive oil as the lubricant on the pan.
Yeah.
But I'm scrambling eggs. I mean, it's hot.
Yeah.
Am I doing myself any favors, or would I be better off with something like ghee, which is clarified butter for those that don't know? Like, what's the right move there?
I love that you ask questions like this, because this is the level that you're on, and also a lot of the audiences as well, which is like, we want to be our very best, right? Most people, though, Tom, are like, they're not thinking about their eggs and olive oil. You know what I mean? Like,
sure,
they're eating Dunkin'
Donuts
and like mini muffins.
Yeah.
So now we're getting into the minutia, which is you're still so far superior and so far better off by having those eggs scrambled up in some olive oil than you would the like. Mm. Now, what's the good, better, best practice? Even with the eggs, we've got to be mindful of damaging the yolk, right? Through high heat. There's some omega-3 fatty acids there. They're very heat sensitive. And so low to moderate heating with the olive oil, fantastic. And also even eggs, if you talk to a chef, right? Somebody who's really versed in making eggs and omelets, they're cooking their eggs like longer, right? But I know myself, probably you too, I'm just trying to whip those bad boys up and, you know, get busy, right? But the ideal practice is to be mindful that these compounds don't want to get damaged by heat. But we're still so far better off doing that than eating some frosted mini wheats.
Right. Yeah. Frosted mini wheats are so good though, Sean.
That's why I brought it up. It jumped right up on my spirit time.
No, man, that's interesting. Okay, so that's a good angle on inflammation. What about fat loss? Are there implications with olive oil? Are there other things we can add? We'll get to subtracting in a minute, but if there are other things that we can add, is there something on the fat loss side that like...
In my book, Eat Smarter, it was a randomized trial. And they put olive oil up against soybean oil supplementation. And also there's a study that went MCT oil versus long chain fatty acid oil coming from things like vegetable oil, soybean oil. People had greater levels of weight loss and fat loss, and also improvements in their satiety hormones by including monounsaturated fats like from olive oil and also medium chain fatty acids like from coconut and things like that. But also, of course, MCT oil is popping right now.
Now, if you had to guess, so knowing what you know, is that because they reduced their intake of the soybean oil? Or is it like if they kept eating the soybean oil and added olive oil, would they get the effect? Or is it that they've replaced the soybean oil with olive oil?
So they gave either group soybean oil supplement, or the olive oil, or, you know, another trial, MCT oil, right?
So as a supplement?
They're taking an oil, exactly.
Okay, so they're not replacing anything.
Right.
This is their diet's just the supplementation.
Same. Just adding that piece in improved fat loss. That's why I thought, again,
it was so
remarkable. Do they
know the mechanism of action, or do you have a guess?
Yeah, this goes back to, you know, I mentioned this a little bit earlier about like what you're making your brain out of, but the same thing happens with the mitochondria and what kind of efficiency we are feeding our mitochondria, right? And are we gumming up the system? So a good example, and we actually talked about this the last time we talked, this was published in the journal Food and Nutrition Research, and they were looking at the metabolic impact of a meal of whole foods versus processed foods. And so they had the test subjects to consume one of two sandwiches, right? So in one part of the study, they're eating a sandwich that is, quote, processed foods, which is, it was white bread and cheese product, right? And so we mentioned this last time, that's Kraft Singles.
Yeah.
You know, they can't legally call it Kraft Cheese, it's Kraft Singles, because there's not enough cheese in the cheese. And then that's the processed food sandwich versus a meal of whole food, which was multi-grain bread or whole grain bread and cheddar cheese, right? Again, we get into the debate. This is why I started talking about this earlier. What's processed and not? This is minimally processed. Cheddar cheese is like four things. Kraft Singles is like 15 things, all right? Very different products. And also, how long have humans had each of these? And so the two sandwiches are the same amount of calories, same amount of proteins, fats, and carbohydrates. On paper, they should have the same metabolic impact. But after consuming the two different sandwiches, when the people had the processed food sandwich, they had a 50% reduction in calorie expenditure, calorie burn, after eating that sandwich versus when they had the whole food meal sandwich. And what happens is, it's kind of creating this metabolic clog. It's gumming up the system. And again, your body's intelligence is just like, oh, I don't know exactly what to do with this. Let's tuck this away here. It's trying to protect us some kind of way, and is slowing down that expenditure of this less than ideal substance, just trying to figure it out. It's kind of creating this confusion. Now, with that said, this boils down to, what are you making your tissues out of? And this is one of the most important takeaways for anybody. When you're eating food, you're not just eating food, you're choosing what you're making your cells out of. Every cell in your body, from your heart to your brain, is made from food. We have this cognitive bias in our reality. We think we're just here, right? You are literally made, as I'm looking at you, I'm seeing the food that you've eaten.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes, it is mind-blowing.
Okay, so all of my cells are turning over. I am literally what I eat, but do you pay attention to there are some very smart people that are like, a calorie is a calorie, brah. Yeah. And so this is one of those things, you're very eloquent on this point. I try not to be arrogant about this. I try to look for, as you say, what am I wrong about? Yeah. So I do not value myself for being right. I promise you, like, none of this is coming from a place of like, I know something you don't know. But I have a like allergic reaction to people who are like, a calorie is a calorie and there's no difference. But there are really smart people who say that. And I don't, it may just be that I'm so ignorant, I can't see past, like, but it seems obvious to me that if I'm eating polyunsaturated fatty acid or polyunsaturated fats that get stored as polyunsaturated fatty acids, that that is going to be materially different than another kind of fat, even if they're stored within the same fat cell. But I don't know the ways in which they are different. So can you, are you familiar enough with their stance to steel man that argument? And then can you tell me where what they're missing?
Yeah,
because if
course,
you can, I would
absolutely
love that.
Because when I came into this, I went to a conventional university and my nutritional science class, one of those big auditorium classes, the first day of class, the teacher said that if you want to manage your weight, you just need to manage calories. And then the calorie
Which is
dogma
true, by
began.
The way.
Absolutely.
An extent, if I make you hungry enough, if I deny you of calories enough, you will lose basically all of your tissues, but you will get skinny. So we know that's true, but where does that begin to break down?
Yes. So today, again, it has its place in science. And what we tend to do, of course, is we get bought into an ideal. We might see results with ourselves and even with people that we're working with. But what tends to happen is we'll ignore the people who aren't getting the result with our thing. Mm. It happens with the very best researchers, scientists, physicians. We mean well, but we tend to think that our way is the way, right? Like the Mandalorian. And there's so many other versions of that. And so today what we've uncovered is that there are epicaloric controllers. There are multiple controllers that control what calories do in your body versus the next person. All right. So one of them I just mentioned is the quality of the food itself is going to react differently in your body. So you might be doing a point system or managing your calories, but you're eating processed food and creating a barrier in your body's ability to expend the calories that it possibly could if you were eating real food.
Why?
We can't let that go. We can't just be like, that doesn't exist. But we get that tunnel vision when we're just like calories in, calories out. That's it. End of story. And I'm so glad you set this up by saying these are very, very smart people. But here's the thing. If we take a very smart person and we teach them the wrong thing, they become world class at teaching the wrong thing. Mm. All right. And this happens a lot in medicine today. All right. But of course, there are great innovations. There are great things that happen. But we have to look at the results. Is it working for the majority of people? And the data clearly shows that most people who are doing a standard calorie restriction, they do lose some weight, then something happens. Something happens, which that something is their metabolic rate adapts, their body's expenditure, because when you cut calories, it isn't just magic fat loss time. It's going to change the way that your thyroid is working. It's going to change the way that your adrenals are working. It's going to change the way that your brain is working. Everything is going to get affected, and your body that's hardwired for survival doesn't give a shit about you trying to lose weight. It's going to adapt, right? But then it's just like, you just need to diet harder. You need to cut more calories. Have you tried a caloric deficit, right? I've seen this so much to the degree that people end up, they were coming into my office when I was doing clinical work, they're on 900 calories a day and the scale's not budging. Mm. And they're broken, right? They feel broken and just in tears, like, I'm trying so hard. Why won't this work for me? And oftentimes they have the story, it worked before. They did this thing before and it worked. But this is us trying to say, you know what? This human body that has evolved over millions of years, we can just operate it like a calculator. It isn't this ultra complex, highly sophisticated. You've had on Michio Kaku, I believe,
yeah,
right? Michio Kaku said the human brain is the most complicated organ in the known universe, the most complicated object in the known universe. And we're just like, I could trick you, silly brain, right? I could trick you with a little caloric manipulation. Your hypothalamus is the master gland in your brain, and it's an integration point for your endocrine system and your nervous system, okay? Your nervous system is kind of responding to the environment and providing feedback, internal and external, right? And we know about the neurotransmitters that are associated with the nervous system. So we've got stuff that makes us feel good, stuff that makes us feel terrible, stuff that makes us feel pain, all the like. The endocrine system is your hormones. These are essentially chemical messengers that are sending messages, these little metabolic DMs from cell to cell, to keep every cell in your body on the same page. You want the community with good communication. Communication breaks down. When people say my hormones are out of whack, they don't really know what that means. Mm. But the cellular communication is run amok. And so the things that you want to happen are not happening. All that's getting married in this powerful master gland. Not to mention, it's responsible for controlling your body temperature, your hunger, your thirst, so many other things. And when you suddenly go into this caloric restriction, your hypothalamus, its job is to help your body to adjust to said restriction, all right? So that part of the equation is known, it has to be honored. And the way that people adjust or their body adapts is going to change from person to person. We can't just berate people like, you just need to cut your calories. That's not right. And the rate at which it happens to different people, that's another glaring thing. Like, is everybody gonna be, you know, is this gonna be like an assembly line thing? No, everybody's going to be different because we're all different. And so another one of these epicaloric controllers, I took a moment to talk about the hypothalamus, for example. And this is one of the great things. This is about education and empowerment, right? Because even folks who are, you know, really, they've anchored into calories in, calories out, they still want to help people. And that's wonderful. We're not saying this is wrong. It's this, and you have to understand and respect the complexity of the human body. Mm-hmm. And pay attention to your audience who's saying, I did what you're saying and it didn't work for me, right? Because we tend to want to block that out. With that said, researchers at Yale, it's pretty smart people, all right? Researchers at Yale found that a lot of people today have heard of the vagus nerve, right? Connecting the brain and the gut, this gut-brain connection. And the gut itself is often called the second brain or the enteric nervous system. There's a tremendous amount of neurotransmitter. There's so much action happening in the gut. It's an intelligent force itself. So what the researchers at Yale University found was that the human brain is basically keeping tabs on. It's kind of like a governing entity with the gut. And based on your brain and your gut's assessment of your caloric needs and your nutrient needs, your brain can tell your gut to decrease or increase the assimilation of calories from your food.
That's so crazy.
But it makes sense because your body has this intelligence. Now, the question is, if I've already got all of this caloric energy stored on my body, why would my body still allow me to assimilate so much of this caloric energy? Mm. And this gets into the breakdown of that gut, the breakdown of that intelligence between the brain and the gut. This gets into food scientists being able to manipulate these systems and things to go haywire, right? But with that said, if we are eating real whole foods and eating foods that really resonate well with our body, it's very difficult in the first place to overeat those foods. Like, this is getting into more of the practicality, not just looking at the human body as a glorified calculator, but that it has this intelligence. Because I know you've done this, try to do this as well. I know a lot of guys do. We might try to put on a little size, right? And we're eating a caloric abundance. We're eating more than enough, but it's just so difficult to put on that extra size, that extra weight. You got the dirty bulk, makes it easier.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I can put on fat nice and easy.
Okay, yeah.
Muscle is a whole different question.
The dirty bulk is easier, but if you're doing that with real food, you know, sweet potatoes and high protein foods, fish and things like that.
It's miserable.
Yes. Not only is it difficult,
eating so much,
it can be miserable. And I was fascinated by this topic, so I looked into it a little bit more. And I believe the researchers are based in Kansas City. But what they found was essentially that our tongue, even the human tongue, is ridiculously intelligent. But I was wondering, why do we suddenly not have a taste for something, right? We're eating a food and then it's just like, ugh, right? Something that's good, that first bite, few bites in, you're just like, it's not as attractive, but it slowly goes away. Our taste buds literally change. The proteins that we're producing as well change as we're eating.
In your mouth?
In our mouth, absolutely. And over time, the overall palate, because you know, you've heard this as well and probably experienced this, our cravings and our desire for certain foods changes. Mm. Like, we could just lose our desire to do what we were doing, which I was getting fast food 300 plus days a year. If I had a buck, I'm pulling up in that drive-thru, right? The drive-thru diet.
You know what I mean? Did it for years.
But now it's just like, I have no attraction whatsoever to that food. And if I eat it, it tastes so fake. Mm. So fake. There's this intelligence that's been nurtured. But if I kept eating that stuff, guess what's going to happen? It's going to switch over. And I'm going to crave these artificial things, especially these chemicals, you know, artificial colors, flavors. You want to talk a little bit about artificial flavors?
Tell me.
So this was a huge breakthrough in food science when researchers did the thing that kind of like what we're talking about today, everything breaks down into chemistry, right? So a certain flavor is just a compilation of certain chemicals. It's a chemical complex. And so using a gas chromatograph, they could identify the flavors, the chemicals that make the flavor of strawberry, per se. And now we could take that strawberry flavor and add it to other shit, right? So now we got strawberry flavored ice cream, no strawberries necessary, strawberry flavored soda and candy, all the things. And it might not taste exactly like a strawberry, but it's just enough to muddy up the metabolic waters and confuse your system, right? And so,
because you're saying that my body will react to those cues in some way, that even though it isn't a strawberry, it's tripping enough of those signals that my body anticipates a strawberry?
This is where some of the magic happens right here, because we evolved attaching certain nutrients and caloric density to certain flavors. Again, this data is not just coming from us, it's coming from our ancestors. And so when we're getting a certain flavor note without that even sweet, if we get a sweet sensation, but it's not coming along with the expected nutrients and or caloric density, we think we could just trick our body. But now a recent study just came out, you might have seen it getting passed around, looking at the changes that happen with the microbiome in association with artificial sweeteners. Not to say again that they can't be used to great success for some people, but you can't think that the body and the brain is stupid. Like, I'm gonna give you this sweet taste with none of the side effects. And one of the studies that I put in Eat Smarter as well found that the consumption of, you know, like sucralose, for example, increased the production of insulin, all right? It's not supposed to, but insulin's going up. What happens when insulin goes up? Insulin is that lock and key to open your fat cells up, store more shit, right? We think we can trick the system, but our bodies are far smarter than us. And I started the show saying that, like, there's so much that we don't know, and we're trying to figure stuff out. We don't want to act like we've got it all figured out when it comes to like artificial sweeteners, for example. They have their place. It's cool we can come up with this stuff, but we have to keep an open mind that it might not be exactly what we think it is.
I'm going to reframe it a little bit. Tell me if this lands. I get the impulse to say that the body is smart, but it might be more useful for people to understand that the body's kind of dumb. And it's lagging behind, because what it is you had a blind watchmaker over millions of years of evolution, and the people that started secreting insulin or whatever, when they put it in their mouth, they survived longer than the people that waited until it hit the gut and actually got digested. And by then it's too late, and your sugars are elevated for too long, and so you end up dying younger than other people. And because of that, now as you're, you know, in a modern context, and you have all this fake food, your body doesn't realize that, oh, there's a difference between this thing, which is giving me these signals, which is why it tastes so good. And we're like, oh my God, this is amazing, because evolution told me, yeah, eat strawberries, eat these sweet things, because they're only here in this narrow window. As it's leading up to winter, you need to put on a little fat. And so one, I trigger a response that's more likely to make you fat from things that taste like fruit. But the reality is that the body doesn't see the difference between this engineered thing, which shouldn't trigger all of those responses, but still does. And this is why people should wait until the end, because I have something tied to this that you've said that I think is brilliant and is really going to unlock something for people. But I am going to make people wait till the end for it. But that, to me, once I understood, oh, okay, I get it. My body thinks, because of evolution, my body thinks these mean X, Y, Z, but they don't mean that anymore. And so now I'm getting myself into maybe a better bit of trouble, but still a bit of trouble than if I were just shoveling the full sugar version of these things in my mouth.
Yeah, I love that. It's a great balancing act to look at. Let's look at the other end of the spectrum, which is the body's just dumb and just responding to these inputs. And the reality is probably going to be somewhere in the middle here, as with most things.
Yeah.
But, you know, just taking that on, like, this is how our system can be manipulated, clearly. We have brilliant scientists who were able to, you know, again, use a gas chromatograph and break down that flavor complex, but also create things where we have this vanishing caloric energy,
yeah,
right? Where we eat. I was just talking to my youngest son about this because he was asking about teeth. Like, something came up about wisdom teeth, right? And I just got into this conversation about it that, you know, a lot of American adults, like, our wisdom teeth don't come in, right? And they're all usually impacted or they're crooked or whatever. And it didn't used to be that way. Like, all of our teeth would just come in normally, right? But a part of that, my wife brought it up, was she's from Kenya, right? And so, like, they grew up eating sugarcane, for example, like chewing on stuff, having hard stuff to chew on. But it was more so her mom's generation. With her generation, they get more and more processed food coming in, right? And also very low-tier carbohydrate-based foods versus the hunter-gatherer. Like, they have the Maasai there as well, who will still have this husbandry, and they're doing, like, the milk and that kind of thing. Then they've got another tribe who is out with the fish and that kind of thing. Better dental health, both areas, right? And so we're getting this conversation about not chewing hard stuff. And he had this thing come up, like, what about, like, chips and stuff? Like, that's hard. But it's like one crunch, like one good crunch, then it turns into sauce.
Yeah.
Right? It turns into mush. And it's this vanishing caloric density where the brain, you got this big, intense flavor, and you've got this chewing action that takes place, but then it disappears. So our bodies get tricked, in a sense. Going back to, it can be a little bit slow. It can be Lloyd Christmas. Right? It could be a Lloyd Christmas version of itself. That's Dumb and Dumber for anybody who's not seen the movie. But that aspect of the body being tricked into thinking it's consuming less calories than it actually is. Because, hey, it disappears. It's not a big input coming into my gut. Right? So we have brilliant scientists who figure this stuff out. At the end of the day, though, the human body is going to take its due. And it's going to figure out, or stop trying to figure stuff out when it keeps being faced with all this abnormality, you know, all of these things that it's never been exposed to. And that's what we're seeing now as a society. We're the sickest society in the documented history of humanity. We have the highest rate of chronic diseases ever known to man. And we're supposed to be so much better than this. We are so smart. We're so technologically advanced. Why are we so sick? You know, this should be one of the things that we think about every day. Like, this doesn't make sense. And to have this generation be the first generation to not outlive our predecessors, that our lifespan is reversing, that should put off all kinds of red flags for us to say, hey, if we're going to be results oriented, something's not working. Something in this equation is not working. Could it be that we're trying to trick our bodies into doing the things we wanted to do versus us understanding the things we evolve with and bring it.
If you want a fighting chance against the competition, you need to be using the best technology and platforms in the world, like Shopify. For whatever and wherever you want to sell, from launching to going international, Shopify is the global commerce platform that will help you grow at every stage of your business. Shopify is your all-in-one platform to quickly and efficiently take your business to the next level. Now, I love everything about Shopify because it makes it so easy for you to start, run, and grow your business. It didn't used to be this easy. I'm telling you, back in the day, it was a lot harder. I'm so jealous. Shopify powers more than 10% of all US e-commerce because businesses that want to grow quickly and efficiently choose Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/impact, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/impact now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/impact. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You will never be able to reach your full potential if you are riddled with stress and have a lot weighing on your mind. I can tell you from my own experiences with stress and negative thought loops, you have to find a way to work through whatever it is that's weighing on you if you're going to have any hope of achieving your goals. Therapy can be an option for working through things, and for an online therapy option that is super convenient and flexible, be sure to check out BetterHelp. With BetterHelp, everything is 100% online, and getting started is quick and easy. A brief questionnaire matches you with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no extra charge. Get things off your chest, process through things with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/impacttheory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/impacttheory.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
And more of that.
Can I give you my favorite quote from Thomas Sowell?
Please do.
The last 30 years have been marked by exchanging what worked for what sounds good. As somebody who was in the food industry, I can tell you we were breaking ourselves in half trying to like do right by the people eating it. But science changes, and so who knows? Like 10 years from now, we may realize things we were doing didn't make any sense. But we really were trying, like sincerely, even just the right metabolic answer over profitability. And we made decisions that cost us hundreds of millions of dollars. So I put my money where my mouth is on that. But inevitably, time will look back and say, you should have done it like this, you should have done it like that. Yeah. I recognize that. But we make things that don't necessarily work because, hey, we want to drive the cost of food down. Hey, we want to make sure that the farmers that are making the things that make food taste better and people like it more, and you know, therefore they will eat them. We want to make sure that we subsidize that. And so it's like the string of things. But I remember back at Quest, that this was still in the height of fat is going to kill you days.
Yeah.
And we were like, no, you guys have this all wrong. Like fat is going to be this huge thing. This was that I had never heard of ketogenics when we first started Quest. And we start learning about it. And I'm like, oh my God, like this is amazing. Could have cancer implications, like all this stuff. But this is all happening as the government is like, we're going to tax food with fat. And like they were going crazy on anti-fat. And we're like, whoa, like crazy. You may mean well. I'm perfectly willing to accept you actually believe what you're saying.
Yeah.
But you are moving us in the wrong direction. And so when I look at age or the length of life expectancy now going backwards, and I think, but they don't intend to have that effect, but damn,
yeah.
We replaced a lot of things that worked for things that we wish would work but don't actually. So at what point do we have to hold ourselves accountable, pharma, food? Like at some point somebody's got to say this shit isn't working.
Yeah, it takes a lot of courage to, you know, we all have our biases. It's important to come into the conversation with that and be willing to continuously question your biases. And that might mean that you're going to be wrong. And here's one of the other things, especially about food science. You're going to find stuff that validates two totally different perceptions. But what I like to do is like, what does the majority of data say? And also my biases towards what have humans been doing the longest? But even still, I have to be open to the fact that maybe a Twinkie might activate some kind of hidden
longevity
human
pathway.
Yeah, like fucking we can become telepathic or something.
I'm willing to go on record to say Twinkies do not do that. But yes, you're 100% right. And even that, I'm joking because you're right.
Yeah.
You have got to open yourself up to that.
Yeah,
sure.
And it's beautiful because what happens is this really interesting thing takes place where you start being right a lot more when you're willing to be wrong and proactively
facts.
Looking for ways that you're wrong. Right now, we're living at the golden age of my way is the way. And this is coming from the top down in society and the bottom up. And so I love this piece because, you know, just again, what we've experienced the last couple of years, the most obvious thing was not addressed. And I said this at the very beginning, and I was looking at the data coming out of Italy and seeing that upwards of around 89% of the folks hospitalized had one or more pre-existing chronic diseases. And I was like, oh shit, like this is our Super Bowl moment. This is our time. We've got to focus on getting our citizens healthier. The instant argument comes up of we can't get people healthier overnight, right?
And so let's not talk about it? Was that sort of the underlying?
The problem is when fear takes over as well, you know, that's another part of the ingredient, the recipe that can make us ignore essential basic things. But here's the thing that I wanted to communicate. If you look at the vast amount of peer-reviewed data that we have, we can absolutely derange our metabolism in a day, or we can improve it in a day, right? So just for example, one night of sleep deprivation. Guess what's gonna happen to your immune system? Guess what's going to happen to your insulin sensitivity? Guess what's going to happen to your leptin and all the things? There's going to become dysfunction, opening, increasing the risk of you getting sick, period. And so Appalachian State University researchers found that simply going for a 20-minute walk instantly boosts immune parameters, most notably neutrophils, natural killer cells. Just going for a walk.
One all walk? Right?
But this is it's a short-term boost. But what if you have that practice integrated, right? Mm-hmm. Not to say that this is the end-all, be-all, or right. some kind of like shield against a viral infection. But here's the thing that we did what we typically do. We have a problem, we try to find a drug for it, right? So I had my eye on the data coming out of Italy, and I was just being a voice of reason and logic, like, let's stay balanced in this so we don't venture into the ridiculous. Cut to a year later, I get a study from the CDC. I know people at the CDC. Mm. And I'll tell you, most of them, the vast majority, pretty much everybody that I know at these entities, they really do want to help people. There can be, of course, decision makers and people in the process that have some, what we tend to do, again, if there's a nefarious outcome, but money's tied to it or the reputation, all the things, they make tough decisions, right? So I keep trying to validate and hold a space for people to be good people. So I'm coming into it with that. Now, here's what I got. This was published in July of 2021. Huge meta-analysis looking at the data from over 800 United States hospitals and over 540,000 COVID-19 patients. And we'll put the study for people. You can put that in the show notes if you like as well, because seeing is believing. Mm. So compiling this huge database of people, what they found was that the number one risk factor for death was obesity. And the thing is, we can have this justification, well, people won't do it. Look at how we were galvanized to do things. I just went to the gym today and I see all the stickers on the floor. Stay 6 feet apart, stay safe. Oh, guess what people were doing? They were doing the things. If it was coming from a place of authority with a little bit of science and encouragement, that fear could have been used as a tool for real empowerment, right?
Do you think there was a perfect storm? Because I think, so part of it feels like 100% so many people, like, confronted with their own mortality still will not change their diet. There's a book called Change or Die, which highlights how few people will actually make the necessary changes when even the change they have to make is deadly simple, they still won't do it. So there's that, but it also coincided right as we are getting to the point where you can't call somebody fat or obese, that's shaming them in some way. And so now it's like people are called onto the carpet for saying that you're overweight. You got this whole movement of healthy at any size, and it's coming right as we're like, we have to do something right now, and we know that people won't change. And you put all that together and years in, and it's still like considered almost like you're being mean.
It all came to a head at the same time, right? You know, having that conversation. So you're blaming fat people for the problem.
Right.
No, we're just talking about reality. We're talking about science. And doing the work where I'm sitting across the table from a patient and they're coming in, they're dealing with something, and be able to look them in the eye. I've seen this so many times. I haven't met one person who didn't want to be healthy. All right. This is a difference. Of course, there's this like, people won't do the thing. We use that in medicine so much that people won't listen. You just have to get better at your job because there's a way. Mm. And so it's finding out what is that person's motivations, you know, what is the leverage point that you can find? Because within that human is the potential for so much. But of course, what happens is we get into a place of complacency. We have a perception that that's way harder than me sitting here having my Doritos, which I used to go to 7-Eleven, open the Doritos, pump chili and cheese into the bag,
nice.
Shake it up. All right. So that's so much easier than me going for a walk every day. Why on earth would I put myself in that discomfort? But I'm creating this physiological discomfort and disease in my body all the while that is going to force me to make decisions, right? So it's just like you get to choose your hard. You get to choose your difficult. Most people are never even presented with that idea.
That's dope.
Right? They're never even presented with that idea. And we're so disempowered in our culture. And also we have a societal revolution of convenience and complacency and disempowerment and lack of movement. We have a society that has made everything so accessible. If we wanted to, we wouldn't have to get up right now to get food sat in front of us. Whereas our ancestors, there was just so labor intensive just to get a meal. Blessing, but also potential curse. All right, we have to keep this in context. So this story that people won't do the thing with motivations, people did shit that they never thought they would do. The last 2 years, we can really look out and see that. At the end of the day, you know, if we can provide more empowerment, science-based empowerment, and create a culture. Right now, we've created a culture of sickness. And so to be healthy, you're weird as fuck to be the healthy person. What state are we in where it's weird to be healthy, right? And a lot of people have seen the study that came out about a year ago, maybe it was 2 years ago, but this big meta-analysis, and they were looking at the metabolic health of United States citizens, and they found that 88% of United States citizens are metabolically unhealthy.
How many?
88%.
What?
Again, give this to you to put in the show notes for everybody as well. And again, if you look at, it's no longer the exception versus the rule. The rule is poor health and disease, all right? So let's go back actually to that study I mentioned from the CDC. The CDC was getting tagged in everything related to COVID, but I was actually reading the studies, looking at the references, not window dressing, looking at it, even an abstract sometimes can be misleading. 540,000, over 540,000 COVID-19 patients, over 800 US hospitals. Number one risk factor for death was obesity. The question is why? That pro-inflammatory state of inflammation. We're pre-inflamed. What is COVID-19? An inflammatory condition. So you already got a bonfire going in your body. Now we come in and we throw some extra fuel on the fire. What do you think is going to happen?
The bonfire, just for people that are really getting into the nitty gritty, is the immune system is already
hyperactive,
kicking off the cytokines. We now know the idea of a cytokine storm. So you have the immune system attacking the body itself. It's kind of like if you have a fly in your house, if you hit it with a fly swatter, all is well. If you bring in a shotgun, you start doing damage. If you bring in 150 shotguns and you just start obliterating everything, you're going to have massive collateral damage. Absolutely. And so you're getting the attack of the virus with all these shotguns, and now you're just tearing the body apart as you try to end the virus.
Exactly. And we can see this with, you know, other metrics. We can measure homocysteine, C-reactive protein. We could see that inflammation is a problem in the body. And this is a consistent thing we see when we're venturing into being overweight and obese. Here's the second leading risk factor for death. Number one was obesity. Number two was fear and anxiety related disorders.
Yeah, I had never heard that until I started researching for this episode. And I was like, what? I get it, but that's shocking.
That should have been everywhere. How in the world could the second leading risk factor for death from COVID, published by the CDC, be anxiety and fear-related disorders? What the hell is going on here? What's the connection? At that time, when the study came out, I had already been sharing so much data on psychoneuroimmunology, on the psychosomatic effects of COVID, all published data. Like, we know this happens. We have an entire field of psychoneuroimmunology, understanding how our mind and our thoughts affect our immune system, right? So if we're in a state where we're riddled with fear, like we've been the last 2 years, bombarded, fear without context, not to say that there isn't something for us to be concerned about and protect ourselves, but to get to the place where we're debilitated and we're frightened, just at the sight of another human being, guess what's gonna happen? You're going to be pumping out all of these catabolic stress-related hormones, and it's just gonna be hammering away at your immune system, especially over time. We didn't just have a week of it, 2 weeks, a few months, years. What do you think's gonna happen? It's not good. So that was the second leading risk factor for death. The third was diabetes and its related complications. Again, going back to this
issue. I can't believe that anxiety and fear outpace diabetes.
Yeah.
It's crazy. That's fascinating to me. I would have, for so long, it seemed like everybody was lumping those two together, obesity and diabetes. So it's very interesting to me that they seem to have a slightly different mechanism of action, so that I would have thought that diabetes would be even more life-threatening than just garden variety obesity. Why do you think they're flipped?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And by the way, I want to throw this little bit of data out here too. So this was published by the CDC as well. healthcare workers obviously had a great level of exposure. So they're a great data set. And plus, controlled environment, we can get better feedback. 89% of healthcare workers who were hospitalized with COVID-19 had at least one pre-existing chronic disease. And over 75, right around 75% of them, obese. Okay, so this isn't, again, sort of, it might be a correlation. We know this is the issue. And so with obesity and diabetes, these two, they do tend to come hand in hand. You know, they're like, they're paired up, all right? They've met on Tinder, they're, you know what I mean, whatever. But there are different metabolic situations happening, all right? Because somebody can be they can have type 2 diabetes and not be obese. And also people who are obese don't necessarily have to have diabetes. This gets back to this very important foundational understanding that we're all different in our body's metabolism. We have a unique metabolic fingerprint. And how our body adapts to things can be dramatically different from one person to another. But what we do is we tend to put these umbrella diagnoses on people, right? So they get the diabetes label if they have, you know, the fasting blood sugar is too high or hemoglobin A1C is too high, whatever the case might be. You're diabetic. That's it. No two people have the same diabetes ever because they're a unique human entity and everything is different in that body. There are, of course, similarities where we can classify people and provide a treatment, but oftentimes it's that standard of care. And this is why we suck at fixing it, because we're not taking the person into consideration. Another thing with battling this issue is we're fighting against ourselves. You know, we're fighting this internal battle and there's a lack of respect. Like our fat cells, this is my bias, Tom. Well, our fat cells are smart too. Of course, again, they could be dumb, but they're really intelligent at helping to keep us alive. Through our evolution, they developed in such a way that they can keep us alive during times of famine. But now we're living in a famine that never comes, not even remotely close. As a matter of fact, it's anti-famine, right? And our fat cells have the capacity to expand their volume by 1,000 times.
Whoa.
1,000 times. Crazy. It's insane. So now the problem is, as that's happening, it's sending out that distress signal that something is wrong here. Like, I have too much stored in this system. There's some kind of infection. Something is breaking down. But here's the beauty. When we start to move away from the behavior patterns that's causing the problem, the body knows how to fix itself. Mm-hmm. It knows how to sort this stuff out, right? This is where we can get into the conversation about a caloric restriction or the like. But the caloric restriction naturally happens when we're eating nutrient-dense foods, because it starts to cover all of these bases, these metabolic bases. Because even the process of fat loss itself, which is it's lost on so many people, there are key nutrients that are involved in the process. Even the mitochondria itself. Our mitochondria is the end destination. We have lipolysis, where the fat cell lets go of its contents, but that shit can get reabsorbed, all right? So lipolysis is a step. Now it needs to get shuttled to the mitochondria to actually be used as fuel, right? We've got cellular respiration and beta oxidation. So now that that's getting utilized, here's the crazy part. The mitochondria really are all of our cells. I can't think of anything that isn't dependent upon the sodium potassium pump. These key electrolytes that enable all of our cells to do all the shit they do, right? Magnesium is also another critical electrolyte in our mitochondria being able to, we having this kind of mitochondrial genesis, creating new mitochondria. We need magnesium to help it to do that job. And the last point, this is so cool. When I was in my university classes, I was taught that the energy currency of the body, ATP. Everybody knows ATP. ATP. No, that's not the bioactive form. The bioactive form is when ATP is binded with magnesium. That's when it's actually bioactive, able to do shit.
I didn't know
that. This is why electrolytes, these key nutrients, are so important. So if we get dogmatic and we're just like, cut your calories, are you deficient in these key electrolytes? Shit's not gonna work as good. What if we start stacking conditions in people's favor using our primitive understanding of nutrition with trying to treat the body like a calculator, but also adding on the advanced stuff, which is epicaloric controllers, so we can really start to get people healthy.
Man, this stuff gets really complicated. There was something you said earlier that I want to go back to around the idea of how much your mind, your psychology influences things. But I also want to be clear. So when I say that the body is dumb, that's probably a more useful way to think about it. But I also believe that if you want to believe in God, look inside the cell. Like every time I look at how cells function, which is way over my head, but even the parts that I can grasp are so terrifyingly complicated that you're like, wow, it is hard to believe that we just like came to that. So it's pretty intense. But now applying that to the mind, it's really incredible how powerful the mind is. And when I was researching you, you were talking about a study where they gave people the same shake. It's the same shake, but they told people different stories about those shakes. Walk us through that, because this was startling to me in terms of somebody trying to figure out this complex game of weight loss.
Perfect, yeah. So this was a study coming out of Stanford at the time, and the lead researcher was Alia Crum, and she wanted to find out if our thoughts might affect our metabolism. And so they blended up a big batch of milkshakes for study participants to come by. And on some of the milkshakes, even though they were all calorically the same amount, they slapped a label on some of the milkshakes that said 140 calorie sensible milkshake, right? Quote, sensible.
Right.
And even though they were 380 calories, and some of the other ones, they slapped on a label that said 620 calorie indulgent milkshake, right? And so they allowed test participants to consume them. They were running a hormone panel to see what was going on with their biochemistry. And so here's what happened. When folks were consuming the indulgent shake that they thought was a high-calorie indulgent milkshake, their ghrelin levels, which ghrelin is this kind of glorified hunger hormone that drives us to seek food, seek nutrition, seek caloric density, seek key nutrients, it creates a situation where we are driven towards food. Mm. When they had the indulgent shake, their ghrelin levels dropped as if they had three times more calories than they actually did.
Whoa.
All right. So essentially, because they believed they were consuming a lot of calories, something that was super indulgent, their ghrelin levels responded. And ghrelin also plays a big role in metabolism overall and metabolism of fat. Mm-hmm. Their ghrelin levels and their desire to eat dropped as if they had three times more calories than they actually did. On the other side, the sensible milkshake, and even again, keep in mind, all the milkshakes are the same amount of calories, 380 calories. But when people had the sensible milkshake, their ghrelin levels barely budged at all.
That's so crazy.
Non-significant, okay? So these folks, what's going to tend to happen is you're going to be hungry sooner after. Even though you had more calories than you thought you had, ghrelin didn't change, okay? And this speaks to, again, every thought that we have creates correlating chemistry in our bodies instantaneously. It's happening 24/7, always, will never stop. But that's the part of medicine. In the last couple of generations, there's been this separation between mind and body. And it is the most ignorant thing because you cannot possibly separate the two. And so understanding, and again, pointing people back to their choice and your ability to choose the thoughts that you want to think. For example, we can tell ourselves, we can basically, Joe Dispenza, you are the placebo. So after I read the study, I immediately thought of him and I really got it. We can tell ourselves that this meal is incredibly nourishing and indulgent, even though it might be a low calorie meal, right? So when people are doing the calorie restriction thing and they might not be happy with the fact that they're eating this, you know, low calorie salad, but telling themselves, and this gets into the debate, like, are we lying? Are we like faking it till we make it? Doesn't matter. You're changing your biochemistry and your
body
works. Does
it work even if you're telling it to yourself? Like, if I know that it's a 380 calorie shake, can I tell myself it's 160 calories, or, you know, that it's the indulgent so that I stop being hungry?
Great question. Because we know the greatest effects come when it's coming from an authority figure, right?
Not surprising.
So another study that Alia Crum and her team did was a skin prick test. And basically they gave people, you know, they pricked their skin and created this reaction, a histamine, kind of skin rash would come up. And then they brought in researchers to tell them that they're going to apply an ointment and either, and it's going to be an an agonist or an antagonist. It's going to either make the skin rash better or it's going to go away.
This is headed.
Okay? And so as study participants were given the cream that was a non-treatment, there was no treatment factor or active ingredients in this cream that can do anything, all right? But the test subjects who rubbed the cream, believing by their physician, by the researcher, by the scientist, that this would help their rash go away, it started to go away within 10 minutes.
It's bananas.
The study participants who had the antagonist cream, where it's going to get worse, the skin rash got worse within 10 minutes. Now, here's the thing. The degree of change, how quickly it changed, and how effective it was based on the study participants' belief about how intelligent their That's practitioner crazy. Was, how qualified they were, their aptitude, their faith in them impacted whether or not the rash changed and how fast it changed, right? So keep this in mind. What usually happens is we outsource our thinking for our bodies to other people. And I know this deeply because this was how I got into this field in the first place. I had no intentions on working in health and wellness. It just wasn't in my perception. But when I went to that physician experiencing some leg pain and he had me get an MRI of my spine, first of all, I didn't even know why I was getting an MRI of my spine when my leg hurt. I was so disconnected from how this entity works. And I go in to see him and he puts the MRI up and he's looking at it with me. And he tells me I have these two ruptured discs and severe degeneration L4, L5, S1. And I'm just like, I'm a kid. I'm 20 years old. I'm like, okay, so what do we do? Let's go. What do we do to fix it? And he looks at me like, whoa, you know, he kind of even pumps his hand like this, like, pump your brakes, kid. And he says, son, you have the spine of an 80-year-old.
Jesus.
This is unfortunately something that's incurable. But we're going to help you. We're going to get you some medication. We're going to help you to manage this. It was a key word he said. We're going to help you manage this. I'm untreatable, uncurable condition. It's only downhill from here, but he's going to help me manage it. And when I shared this with you before, I didn't really, because I've been thinking about this the last couple of years, I had some extra time, Tom. I was like, I asked him a question that I believed prior that I had no grounds to ask him, which is this due or is there anything I can do? Should I change the way that I'm eating? I asked him that question, had no grounds for it, so I thought. Should I change the way I'm eating? Should I change the way I'm exercising? And of course he said, these were the exact words, this has nothing to do with what you're eating. But then he wrote me a prescription to eat some pills, right? But after thinking about it again and again and again, that nutritional science class that I had was before this happened. This was almost 2 years before. I was like 17, 18 in my first nutritional science class, which was a prerequisite on the pre-med track. I didn't have to take it, but I thought nutrition was about fitness. And my teacher was overweight, all right? And so when I saw him, I'm like, he can't really teach me how to be fit. Just so like, I never said it and never really said the words to myself, but just I realized that I had this little disconnection of trust, right? And so I had this in my memory bank that nutrition matters. But when I asked that question for him to give me that immediate feedback that nutrition, food doesn't matter in a disease state, my doctor was not just overweight, he was obese. And I remember him leaning over on me, right? And just like, he was clearly not well. And he's probably doing the things that he believed to be effective. He's not just, you know, not trying to not be healthy, right? But in that moment, what happened to me was the nocebo effect. Right, giving someone a negative injunction from an authority figure that things are going to get worse. Just like that skin prick test. But globally, like for myself, I went from a nuisance of a pain to chronic debilitating pain within a couple of weeks because I believed I'm unhelpable. My life is over, right? And so I carried that with me day after day for 2 years, seeking out multiple, which I always recommend people, if you get a bad bill of news, please seek out another opinion. Getting a diagnosis, it's only the same, like bar for bar, the same diagnosis around 20% of the time from physician to physician, all right? Now, I'm talking about clear difference, but just in general, you know, 20, 30, 40% of the time, there's going to be some plays within that diagnosis that are going to be different. Seek that out. But here's the thing I learned over time. If you're going to seek out another perspective, don't just seek out the same type of thinking. Einstein, he had this wonderful statement that's attributed to him, that we can't solve a problem from the same level of thinking that created the problem. Mm. Right. And so I applied that even in the help that I would implore people to seek out, like ask somebody with a different way of thinking about this thing. Right. But I didn't know that piece of data at the time. So I went to the same kind of conventional thing. And each time I'm heartbroken leaving there, and I'm leaving there with another drug. Celebrex was popping at the time. So I was on Celebrex, and I got Celebrex from the second guy. Eventually get sleeping medication. Eventually, you know, the list goes on and on. I found my little own over-the-counter plus prescription cocktail to knock me out of it.
If you strive to perform your best in life, bringing your energy and abilities into everything you do, then it only makes sense that you would want to be out on the road with that same power, agility, and performance that everyone expects from you. And there's no better option than the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable SUV yet, the third generation Range Rover Sport. You guys know I love staying on the cutting edge with technology, and the Range Rover Sport's cabin features advanced technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, a must, offering you and your family and friends new levels of comfort and refinement while traveling. The Range Rover Sport provides an instinctive drive with engaging on-road dynamics and redefines sporting luxury for the power, agility, and performance you demand in every area of your life. Explore the Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
Night, because I'm in so much pain.
Yeah, see, this is where it gets interesting, because you've got the age-old recommendation, like thousands of years old, let food be thy medicine. Hippocrates, I think it was, that said that all disease starts in the gut. And so we've known this stuff for a long time, and this goes back to that idea of replacing what works for what sounds good. So drugs are powerful, man. Like when you get a drug that really works, like if you've ever had a bad headache and you take Tylenol or Advil, it is awesome. It is awesome. And I've thought, you know, a dozen times more, I'm sure, that I've taken it and thought, I'm so glad I live in an age where I can actually get medicine that has this kind of impact, because it's really powerful. So I get how people end up getting confused, but man, have you got to really look at the data. And so rarely are people actually looking at, was this effective? Did this actually work? Mm. Yeah.
This gets us into this really important part of the conversation, which is I had a conversation with Dr. John Abramson, and he's a professor at Harvard, and he's been huge, and it was not his intention to be involved in so much drug company litigation, pharmaceutical company litigation. And he was just brought in as an expert witness one time, and then just kind of got pulled into that universe. And so he's under so many different NDAs and things like that. He can't talk about a lot of details, but some of the outcomes that we've seen, even in the Vioxx scandal that took place, I could have been put on Vioxx at that time. I was put on Celebrex. Vioxx killed, affirmed in the data, over 40,000 Americans. Whoa. Affirmed in the data, over 40,000. We're talking about the low end. Killed them from this drug that, again, according to the guy who was involved in the damn case, all right, Merck knew about the dangers. They saw it in the data, in their clinical trials. But they still put the drug out because, hey, these non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are hot right now. We got to put ours out, right? And so, again, like there's these little brushes with fate that I have. And specifically, he even shares some of the stories in his book that, you know, young people were dying, right? So like one of the stories that he shared was a athlete, you know, she hit her head and she was like having headaches. They gave her Vioxx. She ended up freaking having a stroke and dying. Yeah. You know, so crazy. But we got to keep this in mind. Merck's doing better than ever. They killed 40,000 Americans, we could argue intentionally. They knew the dangers and they put the drug out. And not to mention all the stuff they did to try to hide it. That's why they were hit with such a huge lawsuit, the fines, all that stuff. But these fines to them are like, it's nothing to them. Like they actually have accounts just kind of like for the lawsuits. Like, it's already set aside. They have the most powerful legal teams in the world. So with that said, knowing so many people who work at pharmaceutical companies, mostly good people, they're trying to serve, they're trying to help people, they really believe in the mission, but they're not in the lab, they're not looking at the data, they're not paying attention to the fact that our physicians are not, when we go to a physician, we think that there's their medical school training for this particular drug they're prescribing. The vast majority of the time, they're educated on that drug by a sales rep. Mm-hmm. A sales rep is educating your doctor on a drug. And they have the chance, if they want to look at the peer-reviewed data, because that's how a drug gets approved by the FDA. It's part of the process. They have this peer-review process. But here's another thing that John showed me that blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. Most of the drug trials that are published in our most prestigious journals, the review board, most of them never actually see the real clinical trial data. They get a summary from the fucking drug company. Who's actually looking at the trial data? The FDA isn't doing that. They don't do that. And a little not so fun fact that I've really been trying to press into culture, because again, we need to check these systems so that when drugs are necessary, we have safety. The FDA, over 75% of their scientific review budget is funded by drug companies. Our FDA that's supposed to be regulating and checking, keeping in check drug companies, are funded by those same drug companies.
Because they pay for fees?
These user fees. The advent of user fees is a recent thing that took place, all under the guise of getting drugs. We need more drugs. We need drugs to people faster. The FDA is like, we need money. So drug companies like, we'll give you the money to get more employees, more computers, whatever you need. Make the process faster, user fees. Now, but here's the thing, Tom, it's not just 75% of their scientific review budget. The FDA's overall budget, 50% of it is coming from drug companies. We have, like, it doesn't take Michio Kaku, right? A brilliant level thinker to see, like, there's a huge conflict of interest here. This is dangerous. But for me, there's still surface. I dug more. Published in the journal Science, one of our most prestigious journals, they look at the process of scientific review for a drug to see, are not just the entity of the FDA itself, but are individuals at the FDA itself being compromised by drug companies? And so what they found was that.
Yeah, I know. I've spent too much time with you online. I know the punchline. This is rough.
What they discovered was that when a new drug is brought up for the review process, the physician advisors who are on the board for approving this approval process end up getting paid by a drug company who's involved in that clinical trial. Almost 40% of the time they receive a payment from that same drug company or a competitor. Okay. Now, how is this legal? It's a post hoc payment. So they're not paying them and then getting the thing. It might be 6 months later.
Right.
It might be 9 months later. They're getting either cash, they're getting a grant, they're getting money. And this is literally, there are cases where millions, hundreds of thousands of dollars. How is this even possible in what's supposed to be the gold standard for drug regulation in the world? It's so riddled with layers of corruption that even the good people who are trying to get good products, helpful products to people, it's being compromised at every level. Last part here, I've got to share. In 2020, two-thirds, because again, how is this all happening? Why isn't Congress or our Senate, why aren't our leaders going after these drug companies in this process and addressing this corruption? In 2020, two-thirds of United States Congress members received a check from a drug company.
Whoa. Now that one I didn't know.
So the question is, how can we get this sick? How can we be this disconnected? Why are we so mentally unwell? The number one cause of death right now here in the United States, Tom, for people between the age of 18 and 45, our prime of life years, the number one cause of death right now is fentanyl.
Really?
Yes. Number one cause of death. Not just overdose, specifically fentanyl. Why isn't this, you know your shit. Why doesn't everybody know this?
So I've started hearing about fentanyl in the last, I don't know, maybe year, 18 months. I'm probably way behind the curve on that. What is fentanyl an opioid?
Yeah, it's in that family of opioids.
Okay.
But it's a synthetic opioid.
And is it used in the medical system?
That's where it started. It's where it got its start. And there are great documentaries on this. Yeah, absolutely. And this question is, why would, when we hear overdose, we tend to have this perception of the person that overdosed. Man, I've got so many people just floods of stories because of putting this data out of like their uncle, their like people are going in because they have pain and end up getting hooked on these opioids. They have no intention on being a quote drug abuser. So many people, and also fentanyl is so deadly, like literally just a few sprinkles of it can kill you, but it's being like laced in so many other products today. Right? So cocaine.
From a drug, like illicit drug perspective.
Yes. So it's being laced in a lot of things, but also
because again, it makes the high better? Like what's the if it's yeah, that you, dangerous?
You can put less of the other stuff in just a little bit of fentanyl.
And right? Fentanyl's cheap?
Oh, super cheap. It's the hottest thing going right now. Again, to the degree it's the number one leading, it's the leading cause of death. That sound, it doesn't even sound right. I know it doesn't sound right. So I spent a lot of time, almost too much time, like looking into these figures and trying to see, like breaking down how this something like this is possible. Mm. This goes back to Purdue.
How many people are dying per year from fentanyl, do you know? Or even just opioids in general?
In 2015-ish, we had about 50,000 drug overdose deaths, just overall. By 2020, it was 100,000. It doubled. Wow. Overdose deaths doubled in that time span. More and more and more fentanyl. Again, this was the trigger was Purdue Pharma. Purdue Pharma, knowingly, they packaged things up so that this was a non-addictive opioid.
Wait, fentanyl is non-addictive?
No, or? That was how they packaged it up.
Okay.
Absolutely.
But it ended up being just as addictive as anything else.
Yeah, and deadly. And so HBO Max, there's a great documentary. And also there's a series on Hulu starring Michael Keaton, of all people.
Dope sick.
Kind of like, yeah, dope sick.
I haven't seen it. Is it good?
It's pretty good. Yeah, it is pretty good. But that's like a fictional implementation of real events. Mm. Versus Crime of the Century documentary on HBO Max. Or of course, like because we have such a visual culture, I like to point people to those things. There are entire books on this subject matter as well. Obviously the data's out there. It's scary.
My more terrifying question is, why are we turning to drugs so much? So all the like rat studies and stuff, and I don't know this literature well, so I'm very much reciting headlines here, but the headline feels so right, I would be surprised if it isn't accurate, that it is very difficult to get a rat addicted to drugs in its open field, like where it can literally just live its life. But if you put it in a cage, then they'll get addicted lickety-split. So my question is, what is going on? Like if we dropped drugs into the savannah 150,000 years ago, would they get addicted or would they be so occupied? I won't even say so thrilled, but so occupied with their life of hunting, gathering, loving, marriage, death, you know, dealing with attacks, like all that stuff that they just wouldn't think about it? Or would they, boom, it's just that kind of thing and they would all get addicted as well?
I love your thinking, man. You know, there's always been mind-altering substances that humans have tinkered with, right? And there's a big movement towards, you know, plant medicine and all these different things for certain experiences. But historically, what it would be involved with is something that might be a rite of passage or might be involved in, like, it's a experience that is a tribal aspect to it. It's always been done with this layer of respect to the thing.
I today, also have a feeling that they were, and I don't know, I am super ignorant on drugs, but like looking at what they've done to weed, where they've made it hyper potent, like massively increased the THC levels. We've done the same thing to fruit.
Yeah.
So I have to imagine, you know, that the drugs, while obviously still psychedelic, may not have packed quite the punch.
Of course, way different scenario. You know, again, our ancestors happening upon this stuff might, you know, take a little dabble and just swear this stuff off, right? Mm-hmm. It just might be overwhelming, too much to the all the things, right? But we, even though our genes haven't changed much in this time, our environment has, and our level of intelligence, in a sense. And I'm saying that to say, I'm trying to set up the answer, which is today is very different because we're seeking it out. We're seeking out a solution to our pain.
What's causing our pain?
I've shared this many times. We have epidemic levels of physical pain and mental pain. Mm. Mental health issues, all-time high. You name it, ADHD, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, everything is up, everything. And nobody's stopping to ask, like, what is causing all of this dysfunction, right? Part of it is, obviously, our exposures, our environments are very abnormal. Our food is very abnormal. And there's a direct inroads, obviously, with what we're putting into our bodies, having, in essence, we can have degrees of these kind of mind-altering experiences, right? Because believe it or not, that bowl of Lucky Charms is a mind-altering experience.
No doubt.
Right? And so, but we have this classification of, oh, these are safe to do. In our society, alcohol is huge, huge, right? It's one thing you're out at the stadium getting fucked up versus you being at home by yourself and doing it, right? And also it's socially acceptable. If the police really want to get DWIs, they just sit outside of stadiums, mm-hmm. but they don't do that, right? It's not fair game. But as a, that is the most socially acceptable psychoactive substance that kills more people than other drugs until fentanyl came along, right? But that's, even still, alcohol is way up there. It's not in that same kind of classification, right? Mm-hmm. Violence, right? Weight gain, all the things. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is, it's just way to the top 10 too, liver disease.
Whoa.
Right? So it's either 11 or 10 right now, right? Our livers are getting fucked up, right? What are the inputs here? Alcohol is one of the big ones, and also obviously sugar too. Okay, so this sets up the point. Oftentimes, we have this perception of what somebody who uses drugs is, right? We negate the fact that over 70% of United States citizens are on prescription drugs, okay? Right now, our society, we are very adept at taking a pill to make us feel something.
That's a really terrifying number.
Okay? It's normalized. And so whether it's self-medicated or your doctor is your dealer, we have a culture that is seeking to suppress our pain, physical and mental, instead of removing the root cause or addressing what's causing the manifestation. I was just talking with Wendy Suzuki, Dr. Wendy Suzuki. She's a neuroscientist out of NYU. I've done some guest lectures for her neuroscience students as well. And she has a wonderful book. It's called Good Anxiety. And she's addressing our epidemic of anxiety, epidemics, because anxiety isn't just one thing. Every person is different. But directing people towards something that's more sustainable and effective, which is addressing what is causing the anxiety. And not just where drugs are appropriate in instances. Absolutely, it's great to have these things. But when it's relied upon, what tends to happen is we're suppressing something. Our body's giving us, in our mind, this important, critical, biological feedback that something is off here. But we don't want to feel the feeling. I don't want to feel that. So we push it down. We suppress it. Take mind-altering substances, whether it's a drug, whether it's food, whatever the case might be. And we're not connected to our humanness. So going back to our ancestors happening upon this stuff, they were more connected to their humanness. Today, we have these voids within our psyche and within our spirit and in our bodies. We're so disassociated from how shit makes us feel. And we're so externally focused. Social media, it's a golden age of television. It's a lot of shit, a lot of great shit competing, right? To not be able to have control. Most people don't, Tom. They're binge watching daily, all right? It's great to have a nice binge watch. I like Stranger Things. It's great, but I put it in its pocket. And if I'm going to be a healthy, sovereign individual today, I need to focus more on creation than on consumption, right? Cultivating my humanness. The biggest change that happened to me, Tom, over those 2 years of pain, I was in so much pain, I was afraid to get up. So I sat and laid on the floor as much as I could in this one-bedroom apartment in Ferguson, Missouri, while I was sleeping on the floor. Everything changed. Unexpectedly, when I decided, number one, of course, I decided to do something when I'd been outsourcing my health and my potential to everybody else.
What happened?
The last physician that I saw, you know, again, I was seeking out, a friend would be like, oh, this person's the best. So three other opinions. And the final one, I was sitting at home, I had my pill bottle, sitting on the side of my bed about to take these drugs to try to knock me out. And I just really visualized for whatever reason, I don't know why this happened, but I visualized the doctor being at home with his family and, you know, kicking back by the fireplace, maybe smoking a pipe or some shit, you know, like a very cartoonish kind of romantic idea. And but the feeling tone was, he's happy. He's not thinking about me. I left with the baggage. He's living his life. And I outsourced my potential to somebody who's not even thinking about me. Not to say that he didn't mean well.
No, but the fuck that. That's a keen insight. Very keen.
Yeah. And so...
so he's not thinking about me. I'm thinking about me. But what makes you... in that moment, are you deciding something is possible? Or I'm just going to try? I'm not going to outsource and I'm going to start over?
Yeah. In that moment, the trigger was a change in my question, my habitual question. Because at the time, I was like, why won't he help me? Why won't somebody help me? Why me? Why me? Why won't somebody help me? And the question changed to, what can I do? What can I do to feel better? And I never thought about that once those 2 years.
Were you fed up and you got to that point? Did you read something? Somebody say something? That moment right there is the most profound change anyone will ever make. So I really want to know what made you make that change.
Being able to work with so many people over the years, this recipe is different for everybody. But for me, it was this recipe of ingredients. One of them was my grandmother. And she had been, in my mind, harassing me to check on me those last 2 years. Because it's like my grandma, like, I'm fine. Like, leave me alone.
She's
grandma.
Just like, are you good? Are you
just
good?
Just checking in on me. You know, what I felt to be way too much. She knew I wasn't okay. But I'd always been the one that was okay.
Was it knowing that she loved you? Like, because I really want to know the recipe to, it won't work for everybody, but there will be more people like you. So somebody loves me.
Yeah.
The doctor's not thinking about me. What else?
Yeah. It wasn't just love. It was belief in me. She believed that I would be successful. She taught me from a young age that I was going to do something great with my life. I was going to be a great man, she would say. My life conditions didn't match up to my blueprint of what my life was supposed to be. And Tom, the reason that I was at this place was because I've been fighting so much of my life up to that age of 20. Like, I'm in Ferguson sleeping on the floor. You know, my mattress is on the floor. And I'm barely hanging on in college. I was the first person in my family to go to college, let alone graduate. Mm. And I grew up in a state where I got kicked out of my entire junior year. I graduated in 3 years of high school. I got kicked out for fighting, right? When I went to college, you'd think I'd get my shit together. I got kicked out of college for fighting, right? I grew up in an environment where we solved problems through violence. And I didn't really feel like I was a violent person. I didn't want to start anything, but if you start it, I'm going to finish it or I'm going to do something.
Right.
And so that way of living, my most formative years, when I really feel like I went from being like a kid to really taking ownership kind of myself and my life, we live right next door to a crack house. And my father, my stepfather, I just thought, because we saw the devastation happen with my uncles dying from crack cocaine, continuously like getting fucked up and end up in prison, all the things, I thought we established that this wouldn't be you. You would never do this. And he's in this house next door. And I was 12, 13 years old. I heard my mother outside yelling at him. And I just kind of peeked my head down the stairs, like, and I heard what she said, that he was in there in the crack house. And he started to walk up the stairs. I wanted to kick him down the stairs so fucking bad. I could have hurt him. I loved him so much. So what I did instead, I ran over to it was a four family flat, and there's a glass door to get to their real door, and I punched the door and I broke the glass of this crack house where they have guns. You know what I'm saying? I was just screaming, I hate you, I hate you, why'd you do this to my family? Fortunately, a friend of the family grabbed me, they hid me. Like, I was hid in this, you know, in a closet somewhere, and like I could still hear all the commotion outside, and they were looking for me. And they were able to de-escalate the situation. But again, I was responding like this. And again, you could see it, maybe rightfully so, right? But I grow up in this very volatile circumstance. I was the one that was supposed to make it. And here I was, I gave my power away. The one who always took his power gave my power away when he gave me permission to. That first physician, when he said I'm unhelpable, it gave me a permission slip to stop fighting. And I took it.
You see me the chills.
So, but that didn't sit well, obviously, with my spirit eventually. It took 2 years and I'd gotten, you know, I was overweight and in a lot of pain. But my grandmother harassing me, you know, checking in on me. And coupled with that vision of, you know, this person says he can't help me. Why am I listening to him? What can I do to get healthier? My life is supposed to be great. What can I do to get well? And I changed the question. And as you know, like the human brain, really questions are the answer. Mm. You know, there's this process in the brain, it's called instinctive elaboration. So when you pose the human mind a question, like this is why shows get us, right? The open loops, like it's seeking out to find answers. And I ask, what can I do to feel better? And also I'm a very practical person, which I turned that shit off for those 2 years. I was like, what are some actual tactical things that I could do to like get better? Like I need to lose weight. First thing I did was Slim Fast. Don't recommend, it's not very effective, but it's because of like, okay, what do I have access to? Mm. But the low hanging fruit for me, I'd always been an athlete. And so I just started going to the gym. Every doctor said, don't do anything, which the worst thing you could do is do nothing. I could still fucking walk, Tom. I could walk. I was in pain, but I could move. And they were telling me, don't move. That's our advice to you. That's how we're going to help you. But then again, they don't talk to me again. They send me out the door with a back brace and some drugs and say, don't do anything. And now not only is my spine atrophying, my entire physiology is. And so just being able to start to move my body to upgrade the food I was bringing in, because again, the real solution at the end of the day was, what was I making my tissues out of? Mm. My disc that looked like two pieces of fried bologna on that MRI initially, the light should be shining through them. It was made of absolute shit, like absolute garbage. I ate fast food every day, unless again, like I didn't have a dollar. Then I ate fast food at the house, well, ultra processed food, which was my favorite meal, Velveeta shells and cheese. I just eat a box of that shit, you know? And ramen noodles, you know, like again, I'm just eating processed food every day. So I'm making my tissues out of really low quality shit. My body's doing the best it can do to keep me alive. Mm. What if I give my body the best stuff? The sulfur bearing amino acids, the vitamin D, like you need vitamin D just for assimilation of nutrients for your bones. We talked a little bit before the show, I broke my hip at track practice just running. Why are my bones so brittle? No, all I knew was calcium from the commercials. You know, but there were so many other things that I uncovered. And here's the last part of the story. The solutions were there the whole time. I just wasn't attuned to them. The books, the resources, the people, they were there. I was just so busy in my world of I'm unhelpable and things can't get better that I just ignored the solutions, possible solutions, access to solutions that were there all along.
That's so powerful. There's a quote, I forget the exact idea, but never explain an outcome to nefarious intent what can be explained by incompetence. And so I don't think people mean to fuck us up. I don't think the drug companies mean to fuck us up. I'm grateful for a lot of the drugs. I don't think the food industry means to fuck us up. I'm grateful for hyper-palatable food, cheap and convenience. I don't think social media means to fuck us up. I'm grateful for the people that I've been able to connect with. You and I wouldn't be sitting here together Absolutely. If it wasn't for social media. So all of these things have had huge benefits in my life, but like you, I sat on the edge of the bed one day and I looked at my life not moving in the direction that I wanted, and I decided to take complete responsibility for the outcome of my life. Now, once you do that, you have to start looking at the data. What's actually working? What allows me to predict the outcome of my actions better? And so that puts you on this very useful trajectory. But if you never have that click over moment, then you get prescribed the drugs, you take the drugs, you go to McDonald's because it has the dollar menu, or at least it did when I was younger. And you know, all of these things sort of snowball you into a really dark place. And I am concerned right now because of the way things are going. And I feel like you gave some crazy stats today, 80% this, 88% that, 78% this, like it's just really, really startling. And so I'm about to tell people the coolest piece of information I've ever gotten from you. which will be the punchline to all this. But before I do, tell people where they can follow you and learn more.
Perfect, man. It's always an honor to talk with you.
Always same for you, man.
People can find me. My show is called The Model Health Show. And, you know, we do master classes on specific subjects. And I strive, same as you, to bring on the very best people in their respective fields. And grateful to say it's been the number one health show many, many times over. And again, this is coming from a guy from Ferguson, Missouri, sleeping on a mattress on the floor. And for me to do this, it really is a testament to what's possible. And just grateful to do the work that I'm doing. People can, of course, you know, hit me up on Instagram. I'm at Sean Model on Instagram. I do a lot over there. And my most recent books, Eat Smarter, USA Today national bestseller, and Sleep Smarter, international bestseller, and it's creeping its way into 500,000 copies sold of a sleep book, which is incredibly
awesome
rare.
Sleep book.
You know, it really helped to change the culture. So, you know, those are the places people can connect with me.
It's amazing, and I highly recommend it. Okay, so back to what we were talking about. The quote that I wrote down when I was researching you is, food is information, but so are thoughts. Thoughts are information. And once people realize what you are eating is having an impact on how you think, believe it or not. So I went on a horrendous journey of anxiety dealing with that. And I realized that 70% of my anxiety, the part that made it overwhelming and made my life near untenable, was from diet drinks. And once I removed them, I could not believe that changed my life in no small way. And the thought that the biggest part of it, it's not the total cause of my anxiety, but the biggest part of my anxiety was something I was drinking, just it seemed impossible. And so getting people to recognize that food is information. It's communicating to you at a cellular level. It's making you think in different ways. We didn't get to it today, but you've talked about how in prisons they did a study. If you increase their nutrition, make their nutrition superior, it decreases the violence pretty substantially. It's insane. So getting people to understand what you're eating, believe it or not, matters. How you sleep matters. Your exercise matters. And what you allow yourself to think matters. And so I hope that they don't need to go through a two-year struggle like you did, or the multi-year struggle that I went through with anxiety, and instead they can learn easily what you and I have learned with great difficulty and recognize what they think matters as well, and that they have to get that right because it's all information. Sean, thank you so much for being here. Speaking of good information, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe. And until next time, my friends, be legendary. Take care. Peace.